The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we celebrate 25 years of our computer editor, Jack Schofield, whose tenure with The Guardian ends next week. When it comes to the world of technology, Jack has seen it all, and he'll be giving us his personal highlights of the past 25 years as staff at The Guardian later in the podcast. We'll also be looking at the latest invasion from the USA. Computer superstore Best Buy has set up shop on these shores, and here's what we can expect.
Best Buy is a new kind of technology store. You'll find the latest products at competitive prices, switched on and ready to test drive. You'll also get a new level of advice and support, thanks to the people who work for us. Their advice is completely impartial, too. At Best Buy, we don't work for commission. We work for you.
What does it mean for our smaller emporia? Well, producer Scott Colley has the word from the shop floor. And in the news this week, Jemima Kish speaks with Google's CEO Eric Schmidt about the recent privacy issues. And we dissect the announcements that the search company made at their annual I.O. conference, including the latest on the Android mobile phone. We also take a look at the promises the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives said they'd keep in the run-up to the elections, and what, in the past 2 weeks of the coalition government, they've actually done for the UK technology industry. Joining me in the studio to discuss these issues are Jack Schofield and Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both. Jack, you're leaving.
I am, mostly. I'll still continue to contribute to Ask Jack. But yes, I'm going to retire to my pipe and slippers because I've already got my pipe and slippers. I shall be freelancing, so I'm looking for work.
And you're looking for work from your comfy chair in your living room, which means you won't have to come into London very
often. I'm getting... it's an escape from commuting. I shall spend more time with my family. I think this is a traditional saying.
In the garden, maybe, as well.
And spend probably more time smoking, so it's not altogether. Not good news,
don't
really.
Retire. It's not good for your health, is what we're saying. Charles, what are you going to do without Jack?
Well, we're going to be bereft. We do have... A new trainee reporter starting next month, Josh Halliday, but Jack is irreplaceable.
Certainly is. Well, keep listening for the next 30 minutes to the latest technology stories here on Tech Weekly. Here's this week's technology news. First, search engine Google has recently come under fire for revelations about the company's lax attitude to its users' privacy. 2 weeks ago, it was discovered that they were under breach of the European Commission's Data Privacy Act for retaining private information sent over unsecured Wi-Fi networks that they captured when collecting imagery for their controversial Google Maps Street View service. Although they quickly distanced themselves from responsibility, downplaying how much personal data was actually collected, this clearly caused privacy groups to shout foul. In many ways, it was fortuitous that the social networking service Facebook also came under fire for similar privacy breaches that same week. Facebook has received the brunt of the negative publicity, but the fact remains that Google's attitude to privacy is wrapped up only in the company's adopted motto, "Do no evil." The Guardian's new media correspondent, Jemima Kish, spoke with Google CEO Eric Schmidt and pressed him on the search engine's latest privacy blunder. She asked him if there were any initiatives Google could try that would increase the public's confidence in the behavior of the search giant when it comes to how they handle our data.
We certainly struggle with this question because society as a group has not decided what is appropriate and not appropriate in the privacy sphere, and each sort of culture and government will ultimately make a decision, and they will differ. So at the moment, what we're trying to do is to do more communications, more conversations with the appropriate legal authorities who do actually have, the ability to regulate this stuff, and publicize what information is kept and what information is not kept. We do understand that this is a very, very serious issue. I'm gonna get myself in trouble here, but basically all of these modern communication systems generate a fair amount of data, right? And we really need to talk. So the typical example we use is that your cell phone knows roughly where you are, and it has to by law, because of emergency services and so on. So how is that regulated and so forth? So there's lots of examples out there, not just Google. I want to be very, very clear here that what really matters is harm, and reputation also matters, right? But harm really matters. So we've looked very carefully at this Wi-Fi thing. So you understand what happened was that a relatively small amount of data was taken when the cars were driving around. And this is against company policy, to be clear. So this is not authorized. So here's what we did. We stopped driving. We stopped collecting the data. And we publicized the fact that this was the case. And we've now secured that data. There appears to have been no use of that data for any purpose other than it's sitting on a hard drive. So it's not, no one has taken it, done anything with it. It's not been given to anyone, nothing. All of the possible scenarios. And the second thing about that data is that it's essentially a packet here and a packet there. Remember, you're driving along, right? So it's not like you're sitting there listening or anything. And so it's highly unlikely that there's any actual useful data in that. However, it was a violation of our policy. So the way Google works is we decided to just announce it. Because it's just better to tell the truth than that stuff. And now we're working with appropriate governments and having them look at it. And we're not going to delete it unless we're ordered to. Right? Because you know, you're trying to be upfront about this. There's a certain amount of this which is just education and getting the facts right. And then there's a certain amount of this which is people just don't like it. And you really want to distinguish between the two. I think for us, this particular issue will be our primary communications issue, I think, for a fairly long time.
Eric Schmidt speaking with Jemima Kish. Jack, what is Google's history with our privacy?
You can't organize and distribute the world's information and keep it private. It seems to me that, you know, the less information is private, the better it is for Google.
It was an interesting comment that somebody made when I was interviewing them a while ago, that this idea that Google is treated like an oracle by people. People simply put in, you know, their deepest, darkest thoughts and hope that they'll get something out. So not only are there issues with privacy in terms of what other people can search, but also in terms of what it is that Google keeps about us. Can you give us a little bit of a background on that as well?
Well, there was the big AOL case, wasn't there, where they released data and New York Times journalists used the searchers to track down the actual identity of a person.
It turned out to be very easy, didn't it?
It was done.
It was only a couple of hours.
Exactly.
That David did.
It's probably true that your searches give away more about you than you would like people to know, and that, you know, gives Google a special position.
The data that was collected that Eric Schmidt talked about and that we discussed last week was personal data or personal information that was streamed over Wi-Fi networks. It wasn't actually even data that was going into the Google database.
It was sort of Wi-Fi snarfing, basically, which was changing channel at some amazing number, like 20 times a second, they say, just basically looking around to see what Wi-Fi channels were out there as they drove through the streets. And as a sort of result of the way the code was set up, it was collecting and capturing some of that data as it went past. So again, these were sort of, if you like, these were slivers of shards of the personal data. So there might be a bit of your email, there might be a bit of your web search, there might be a bit of, you know, an image that you're downloading or uploading. It would only be tiny little fractions of pieces. But again, you don't know how identifiable that is. It's very hard to say at what point you stop being identifiable from data and at what point you are completely identifiable. The data protection authorities in France and Spain and Germany are all investigating it with a view to possible prosecution. Although the Irish Data Protection Authority has said, delete it, you know, just get rid of it. UK Data Protection Commissioner has said, yes, you know, they can delete it. But Google has held back from doing that in the UK because Privacy International is trying to get a review by the criminal authorities to see whether there's been interception of communications, which would be fall either under Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act or Misuse of Computers Act.
Jack, would you say that this is fair, that the UK has a different privacy, that the UK commissioner has a different approach to the privacy than the rest of Europe?
It makes it very difficult for companies to operate if they operate in an environment where, you know, the rules are different. I don't have any view on whether the UK is in a better position or not than everybody else, but one of the huge problems of not just for Google but for the entire web is that you've got a global thing that ignores boundaries, and then you've got a whole bunch of local governments trying to set local rules. It just doesn't work, as you know perfectly well.
I do. I know well.
Having made programmes about it.
Well, also in this week's Google News, she says, deflecting the attention, the company had its annual I.O. conference and presented more information about how they intend to sell their Android mobile phones. Now, Crystal Tips on Twitter commented earlier this week that she was on a bus and was surrounded only by Androids, not by iPhones, which I found quite surprising. But how well, actually, Charles, is the Android doing?
It's doing pretty well in terms of the platform. Sales in the US have passed the iPhone in terms of market share for the latest quarter. There's no solid numbers for the UK yet, so we don't know exactly how it's doing in the UK. But we've been hearing lots of good things about the HTC Desire, which is the latest Android phone. So certainly the Android 2.2 operating system is getting a lot of plaudits from people who've tried it out.
Jack, Google announced that they're not going to be selling the Nexus phone, the sort of Android-enabled Nexus phone online anymore. Yeah. What effect do you think this will have on overall sales? Any at all? Your response suggests that it doesn't.
I think we tend to increase sales, because the one thing that you shouldn't do as a platform owner is compete with your partners. You know, Google will benefit from having hundreds of different phone manufacturers selling thousands of different models on hundreds of carriers in several hundred countries. And it should stay away from competing with any of those people and supporting its platform so that other people make money out of it. Now, you know, given that Google was absolutely inept at selling phones anyway, because, you know, people like to see them, they like support. And, you know, you can't get support out of Google.
Well, I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on this difference between online and offline retail later on in the podcast when we talk about the latest Best Buy store that's launched in the UK. Now, the other big launch at the conference, at the I.O. conference, was Google TV. Charles, what did they say about it? I understand it was quite a series of disappointing announcements.
Well, the disappointment is, I suppose, is that it's one of these things that's been promised for years and years and is promised again and again. Google said, OK, we've got this 60-year-old technology of television and we've got this brand new technology of the internet. Hey, we're going to marry it. You know, and it's sort of as if no one had ever thought of doing that before. It has been tried, you know, with very variable success, but generally none. Many times before, Microsoft has tried it first with Web TV and then with Microsoft Media Center, which Media Center has done okay. There seem to be millions of users in the US. I'm not sure what the number is like in the UK. It's been tried by Apple with Apple TV, but you know, no one really goes for those in the big way. It's, you know, Apple itself describes it as a hobby. Juiced, another high profile casualty. The idea that Google had is that it'll have a sort of set-top box or else it'll have specialized TVs built by people like Sony or Logitech for the set-top boxes. You'll take an internet feed, it'll feed it into your television, and you'll be able to watch the internet on your TV. Doesn't
watch the internet.
Work.
No, that's not the point, is it?
I mean, it's not really how it works.
No, exactly. I mean, what are they going to be watching? Are they going to be watching, you know, Lost streaming? Are they going to be sitting passively consuming it? The point of the internet, ultimately, is to interact with something, isn't it? So,
well, generally, yeah.
Yeah. So, is Google just simply becoming a pipeline, or is that all they want, or do they want to push the boundaries?
They want to be able to sell advertising in the stream. The question is whether you can make the internet work that way, whether you can do the deals with the content producers, whether they'll be happy to be you know, streaming it, whether you can persuade the consumers that they should, you know, give up their cable subscription or add another subscription of some sort, or you know, add another box to the top of their TV in order to be able to sort of get this internet thing, you know, a bit working with the television. You know, there are people who are very pro this. I spoke to James Governor of the consultancy Monkchips, who says, "Oh yeah, it's going to be fantastic." You know, sports is just crying out for having you know, contextual data and statistics so that you can see it while you're watching a baseball game or a cricket game, for example. though, you know, I have to say that, you know, watch any cricket game on you know, the TV these days, and they've got all sorts of things.
Yeah.
They've got all the maps, they've got the stats.
But Jack, isn't the point of having the internet, as I said to Charles, isn't the point of having the internet on your television or simply just having the internet to interact with it?
Not necessarily. What Google, I think, is saying is that if you look at the video distribution end of the internet, there's probably enough of that to make it appealing for some people to watch it on television rather than on their desktop computer. So you're not obliged to.
Finally, it's been 2 weeks since the UK's new coalition government was formed between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. Both parties, you may recall from our election special, were adamant that they would reconsider the controversial Digital Economy Act that passed through Parliament during the wash-up before the election campaign started. Here, in fact, is what they said. This is the Liberal Democrat spokesperson for business, enterprise and regulatory reform, Lord Razzle. But first, Secretary of State for Culture, Olympics, Media and Sport for the Conservatives, Jeremy Hunt.
We said we will review what is in the Digital Economy Act and reserve the right to change anything if we win the next election that we don't think is appropriate. I think that there may well turn out to be some things that don't work in it.
What we would do, exactly what Jeremy Hunt is saying, I think we need to see how... You know, if we're playing a role in the future governance of this country, we would want to do what the Tories want to do, is see how it's working in practice and, if necessary, bring back further legislation to amend it.
Lord Razzle and Jeremy Hunt in our election debate programme last month. Well, Charles, have they said wait and see?
No, they haven't.
Or have they said that they absolutely won't repeal the Act?
They're not going to go back and revisit the Act. They've got too many other things going on. And really, going back to look at an Act which was pushed through even in the wash-up, but which broadly the Tories agreed with, even if there were Lib Dem objections, the Lib Dems are not interested at the moment in going back and fighting with it. They're simply too much parliamentary time is going to be devoted to all the things that they want to get done through the Queen's Speech.
Well, in addition, the educational technology sector was struck another blow this week with the dissolution of BECTA, the group responsible for integrating technology into the classroom. Charles, what happened here?
Well, as part of the government's aim to reduce the deficit, it's closing BECTA by November, which will cut £80 million from the government budget. That means that 240 people will be put out of work. The chief executive of BECTA said he was very disappointed, said that actually it's a very cost-effective organisation because it says that that £1.5 billion has been spent through its procurement agreement since 2002, which has saved, it says, £223 million, an average of about £28 million per year. So it's really a question of whether BECTA is cost-effective or not. And I guess that the interesting thing will be to see whether educational spending on ICT actually rises proportionally, or whether BECTA turns out to have been not so useful after all. It might be interesting to see whether some of the schools with larger budgets actually hire some of these BECTA people part-time to help them out, because I could see that there might be some benefits both for the BECTA people, the former BECTA staff, and for the schools in making sure that they get the best deal possible when they're trying to do procurement, because you can imagine that schools which are trying to procure a lot of IT will be at the mercy of suppliers who might be looking to just use a bit of a competitive advantage there.
Well, the government has also announced that it will be dropping any funding for new technology projects, including the Institute for Web Science, to help develop a UK approach to the semantic web and also bring academics like myself who study the web under one umbrella across the country. The semantic web, of course, is Tim Berners-Lee's pet project and one of the big spends by Labour at the end of their term. Charles, will this make a difference?
I've already seen some people who are saying that they're looking to get the £135 million that was earmarked by Gordon Brown's government for the Institute of Web Science, that they're looking to get commercial sponsorship for that. I think the expectation was that it was going to be based at Southampton University, where Nigel Shadbolt, who's been working with Tim Berners-Lee inside government to modernise it and push things like DataGov UK through, that Nigel Shadbolt would sort of ostensibly want to be one of the top people in charge of it. So it may be that actually commercial organisations will come through and provide a way to fund that. The idea of the Institute of Web Science was that we would make the UK a sort of a best in breed at getting a handle on the semantic web, where websites understand what the hell it is that other websites are doing to it. It's like a sort of almost a sort of super XML implementation where, you know, if you're trying to find out something about Fords, the websites and the way that the information is coded would tell you whether you're looking for a car or a way across a stream. And basically, we would be, you know, better at implementing this than other people.
Well, in addition, there was also a social science aspect, because Oxford University's Oxford Internet Institute was associated with the Web Science Institute as well. So, in fact, it was almost a consortium of web scientists across the UK. So, yes, I think it will make a difference. Jack, what do you think about this?
I think the web is most likely to be driven by commercial interests anyway. Whether the UK can make a difference as opposed to, you know, the American W3 organisations, it's very difficult to say. I mean, you know, certainly the UK should be trying to do things, but how much overall impact it will make is entirely another matter.
It is unfortunate, of course, coming in the wake of huge cuts at university levels anyway. But finally, what about the Queen's speech? Charles, what did it lay out?
There's a raft of measures. You can actually go and see them and comment on them if you go to programforgovernment.hmg.gov.uk. That's program spelt with two M's and an E. And there's all sorts of things, including no ID cards or national identity register or contact point, ending storage of internet and email records without good reason. Open source will be we will create a level playing field for open source software, a right to data bill so government held data sets can be requested and used by the public, data by public bodies published in an open and standardized format, and also DCMS, where of course Jeremy Hunt is. We will introduce measures to ensure rapid rollout of super fast broadband across the country.
What's interesting about what it has laid out, what the Queen's speech has laid out, is how close it is to the Tory manifesto, the technology manifesto. So perhaps is this simply that they wrote it down ahead of time and so they went cut, paste, there you go, thank you very much? Or do you think more thought was put into this?
Well, the Lib Dem manifesto wasn't that heavy in terms of the technology approach. So I think that given that the Tories are sort of the senior partner in the coalition, and given that they had all the ideas down there already, it's pretty much cut and paste.
And are there any particular Lib Dem elements that you can see in what they've laid out, perhaps in the civil liberties area?
Principally in the civil liberties area, about ending the storage of internet and email records, regulation of CCTV, a freedom bill. I think those are sort of Lib Dem thinking.
Well, we will have more on the coalition government's plan for this sector as it unfolds. However, for the rest of this week's news and all the latest headlines, go to guardian.co.uk/technology and read all about it.
Here's your chance to be in the audience for the most popular science podcast on iTunes. On Wednesday, the 26th of May, the Guardian Science Weekly podcast will be recording at London Science Museum, starting at 9 o'clock at night and going on until 10. It's free to get in, and you'll see the Guardian's Nell Bowes, Ian Sample, along with me, Alok Jha, and our special guest, psychologist Dr. Kevin Dutton. We want as many people to come along and take part as possible. Ask questions and clap when they're told to. That's Wednesday, the 26th of May at London Science Museum, all for free. All details are on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
This Friday, US technology retailer Best Buy will open its second store in the UK, hot on the heels of the launch of the first store 2 weeks ago in Thurrock. It seems strange when all indications suggest that retail is going online, particularly for technology. So what do they know about the UK technology market that we don't? Or are they barking up the wrong tree? Our producer Scott went to investigate, and he began by asking the Best Buy UK CEO, Paul Antoniadis, why they've come to this country.
It is the largest consumer electronics market in Europe. And when we came in and conducted our consumer research, which was well over a year, we spoke to thousands of consumers. We really saw consumers that were dissatisfied, and they wanted a new, fresh way of shopping for consumer electronics. And we were compelled to enter the market to help improve that customer experience, because we want to be viewed by the consumer as the consumer's champion for consumer electronics.
as the trend for shopping, especially tech shopping and electronics, seems to move online, it's interesting to open a whole new brand and a whole new chain of stores in such a competitive area. Why have you decided to do that rather than maybe, say, launch an online presence in the UK?
Yeah, so we've launched our bestbuy.co.uk site. It's been up for a while. So we recognize the importance of having a transactional website, and we're launching that in the autumn. The trend of folks going online is because there wasn't an alternative for experience on CE, right? So we believe we're going to create a tech enthusiastic environment where you can come in, go online, get your research, come on in, check out the experience. Let's just use motion gaming or 3D TV. And you know what? We feel our prices will be competitive. So why go back home and buy it online? Just buy it here. We think that experience has been missing in the UK, and that's why partially there's been an increase in online sales.
Just outside the front door of of your lovely store here, there's a PC World and a Currys to one side and a Comet to the other. What is it that you think that you can offer that's different to them? Because there are similar lines, there are similar prices in here. So what is it that you believe will bring customers across this side of the street from those over there?
We had 4,000 people apply for positions in this store. And of those 4,000, we picked the best of the litter, which is a little over 100. We spent 9 weeks training them, educating them on how to have a conversation with the customer and to listen to their needs. And we believe that unbiased assistance, that knowledge, that resourcefulness will really, really separate us. The other thing that is different about us is we've built this store that is really different from our competition, from the aspect of we got a really strong green tech proposition where we can help consumers save on energy or introduce them to electric cars, electric bikes, electric scooters. You're not going to see that anywhere else.
What are the trends that are going to be key for you in this store?
3D trend, I'm not going to speak to, I'm sure you're well aware of. I think that's going to really take hold. But what also excites me is the internet-enabled televisions. Now, they're not the best right now. They got a decent range of widgets. We're not satisfied for us techies out there. But you know what? They're moving in the right direction. And I'm really enthusiastic about what that LED TV or internet-enabled televisions are really going to bring to life. And the fact you can take that content, as many of us who are listening to this or reading about this, across all three screens. Your typical UK consumer doesn't know how to do that. So whether it's through Slingbox or whether it's a simple widget, we can help the UK consumer really get the most out of their devices. So internet-enabled TVs I'm really excited about. Energy efficiency product I'm really excited about to help customers save. And 3D TV.
Paul Antoniadis, CEO of Best Buy UK. Charles, what are the latest figures for online retail?
Okay, online retail is very big. In 2009, according to the Centre for Retail Research in the UK, it was £38 billion, which is 30% of European online sales, a growth of 12% in that year, and it now makes up 9.5% of UK retail trade. It's expected this year to grow by 12.4% and make up 10.5% of the total retail sales in the UK.
So given these figures, what do you think are a physical store location like Best Buy? How are they going to fare in the UK in this market?
If they get people who are walking through, being in a sort of retail experience, that's going to do okay for them. Generally, though, if they're trying to open a big nationwide chain, the challenge is always that computer screen tends to be closer to you than a shop.
Jack, how do you actually go out and physically buy technology? Do you go online? I see something I like, I do my research, and then I go try it in a shop, and then I go home and I get it for cheaper somewhere else. What's your process?
I tend to buy most things from Amazon, but then I know what they are, and I've reviewed them. I may have played with prototypes, so I'm not in the same position as the average consumer.
Well, do you think that the Best Buy store experience that that the CEO is talking about, you know, these experts and the fact that they've trained up all these people and, you know, unbiased opinions and this and that the other, do you think that's enough to get people across and through the door?
It's difficult to say how big the market is. I mean, clearly there's a whole bunch of people who will buy online, whatever else happens, and they're the techie ones. And there's a whole bunch of people who will never buy online, and they really want somebody to hold their hands and tell them, you know, you need to buy this and do X, Y, Z with it, and so on.
I suppose I have that same attitude with things like bikes. I'm too scared to buy a bike online, though friends of mine who are really into bikes will happily buy a bike online.
Hmm. So there's a spectrum of potential buyers. What we don't know is how big the potential market for something like Best Buy is. I don't think it's a lot of interest to me. I like fries. And I like fries because I go into a Fry's in America. I buy lots of things I don't need.
That's right. Fry's is a big US superstore that hasn't tried to make it over here. I mean, have you seen other US technology store imports that have come over? I mean, things like Circuit City, all these technology stores tend to have stayed over there, whereas we've been dominated by PC World, Curry's, Dixon's, all of those brands.
I used to like Radio Shack when Radio Shack was around. That was quite a good chain. You can get all sorts of incredibly useless bits and bobs, but you know, if you were handy with a soldering iron, hell, you could pretty much build anything.
We have Maplin. They don't have Maplin in America. I go in Maplin. It's wonderful.
Well, Best Buy's newest store opens in Hedge End in Southampton on Friday, the 28th of May. And finally, this week, The Guardian says goodbye to one of its longest-standing employees and one of the backbones of its technology coverage. Jack, you're leaving us for Pastors New. What's been the highlight?
I'm not entirely leaving you because I will be continuing to contribute to Ask Jack. Lots of people have been here longer than that. Several people still here who were here when I joined.
Well, certainly not in the computing
area. But then, you know, computing was a new area. It didn't exist before. Well, we had a thing called Micro Futures, which is where I started writing a weekly column. And I think I probably was the first member of the Guardian staff to have a computer on my desk. And somebody came over and said, "Is that a TV set?" Well, actually, it's a computer, as I expressed. Oh, he said, "Will we all get one?" I said, "Eventually, yes."
And now the banks and banks and banks. It looks a bit like a call center in here.
Yeah, exactly.
So what has been the highlight, Jack?
Well, oddly enough, the real highlight was the appearance of Mosaic, the web browser that did pictures, you know, because we had the internet before we had the web. And we had things like Gopher, but you know, we had menus and things. But actually having pictures on the website and seeing, you know, video from India and was actually quite remarkable.
That was around 1994, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
It was a real window, wasn't it? A window into another world.
And the second thing that happened was then we got broadband, because in the early days you tried to do everything in 2 minutes. You know, you had scripts, you had download managers, you know, to minimise your online time because, you know, my phone bill was like £400 a quarter. But to suddenly have to go from using the internet for 5 minutes a day to only being without it for 5 minutes a day. I mean, now the train goes into a tunnel, you say, "Where's the internet gone? You know, something's wrong here." So it's been a complete reversal of that whole thing of being online.
In terms of the coverage of technology, what would you say has been some of the biggest stories? Was it things like Mosaic? Was it the emergence of the web bubble in the early 2000s? Or was it even the contemporary social media scene?
Probably the web bubble was the major event. And it wasn't actually just a web bubble. It was a whole, it was a whole industry bubble. Newspapers have covered computing from, you know, the 30s, really, electronic data processing. But it was very much done in the same way that newspapers covered shipbuilding, you know, or the aircraft industry. What changed with the arrival of people like me was said, well, we do this. You know, we know how to write programs, even if we do it very badly. We have our hands on the keyboard. We understand how software works. So it was a user view that hadn't existed before. And that I think, was the change that really made a difference.
Now, some people have argued, Jack, that you have a distinct Microsoft slant, that you're more partial to Microsoft, shall we say, than Steve Jobs' Apple. Why? And would you say that, actually?
Well, I wouldn't. I'd say that if you fairly and honestly report Microsoft, then that looks biased because there are so many people with access to grind. You know, it is true that unless you start off by saying, "I hate Microsoft, this is how evil they are," then you look biased simply because there are so many. Well, actually, there are not very many people. There's a small number of people who have very loud voices. There are, 500-ish million people using Microsoft Office. There are 1.25-ish billion people using Windows. Those are consumers. Those are readers. Those are people who deserve honest coverage that tells you what Microsoft is up to, for good or bad. And just to use them as a hate figure is not just pointless, but it's stupid. It's stupid journalism. I mean, the other thing is that I'm old enough that I remember when Microsoft were freedom fighters. There was a time when IBM was 70% of the computer industry. It was not just bigger than everybody else. It was twice as big as everybody else put together. And although it is true that Microsoft became the IBM of software, it's also true that Intel became the IBM of chips, that Cisco became the IBM of communications, that Dell became the IBM of PCs, Google became the IBM of the web. So although Microsoft might look dangerous, Microsoft and Intel are still smaller than IBM. So, I find that the people who get over-hysterical about Microsoft, I kind of think, you haven't lived.
Are there any people or any stories that you wish you'd covered?
I kind of would have loved to have done Tom Watson.
I have to of IBM rather than the Cabinet Minister.
Yes.
Yes.
A very, very important distinction, isn't it?
The Cabinet Minister is a lovely bloke and I like him a lot. But Tom Watson was fairly close to God for me. The old man Watson had built IBM and made it a mighty company. I can say, I talked to Clive Sinclair, I knew Alan Sugar or whatever, but it's not the same as, 100 billion corporation that actually, say what you like about IBM, and I've said a lot of rude things, but it's still IBM computers that run the banks, that run the supermarkets, that deliver food to the shops, that keep the planes in the air, that the insurance companies run on. And if you removed all of that IBM kit, Western civilization would probably cease to operate altogether.
Well, the Big Blue, alive and well, and the iPod, a toy. You heard it here first. And also from Jack throughout his 25-year tenure. Well, that's all for this week from Tech Weekly. Many thanks to our studio guests, Jack Schofield and Charles Arthur. Our producer today was Scott Cawley, and I'm Alex Kratosky. Now, next week, we'll hear from Jakob Nielsen, one of the leading lights in user interaction design, whom you interviewed, Jack. So you'll be back, at least in voice, next week. Jakob will offer a few tips on what to bear in mind when developing content for the new interfaces, the tablets. Come back on Tuesday for more. We'll see you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.